We'll...
Oh, just barely. You get lost in the parking garage.
I did.
I see, okay. You ended up in Shelburne. Okay. The story behind that comment is that Julie and I left the office at the same time and she offered me a ride. I said, no, I'll walk and I'll race you, and I've been here for about 20 minutes. So, sorry. The garage is, you know, it is confusing. Okay. All right, hi. Oh, dear me. What? She's never driving over here again. Okay. All right. A few reminders. And one of those is that after class in here Wednesday, Julius Wilson will be speaking. And that's highly recommended. The second is that the exams are here. If you haven't gotten yours, you can get it after class. Third is that there are instructions on the website as of this afternoon for an exercise that you are encouraged to do that is worth potentially 8 points toward the total for the course. And it involves analyzing your exam one. Now, that's why I suggested that you hang on to the answers, because you'll need them in order to do the analysis. The instructions are on the web, so go there, get the instructions. It's due a week from today, so you'll need to get started on it. And it's due a week from today so that we can read them and get them back to you, so you'll have feedback before the second exam, which is 2 weeks from today, this being the shorter of the three units. The key for the multiple choice exam, that is the questions themselves, you already know what the right answers are because they're marked on your answer sheet. But the questions are posted during the day outside C-150 Living Learning on the wall. So you can take your answer sheet, find out what the questions were there during your spare time. Anytime there's somebody in the office, it will be there. Okay. Some of you had questions about interpreting the answer key. And let me just show you how that works. The correct answers are marked. For example, here, the correct answers are printed next to the line for the item that they refer to. So in this particular example, the B is the correct answer for item 3. The D is the correct answer for item 28. These are no problem, but this one refers to this item rather than the one above or below. Okay? It's fairly obvious after somebody points it out to you, but it's not. If you got confused about it, don't worry about it. It happens every semester. Let's see. Other information you might be interested in. The distribution of scores. That's the total points for the exam. And the average was 51. For some reason, a whole mess of people got 52. Usually it's more even than that. I don't know what that one was, but that's the way it is. And so those points go on to the total, and writing quizzes that you've done, writing exercises, and the other two exams, and the writing exercise, the analysis of your exam, all of those get added up. And at the end of the course, the people who have the most points get the highest grades, and the people who have less get lower grades. Simple enough? Okay. Anything I've left out? Any other questions? Do you have any announcements? Or? Oh, yes. Thank you. I whined on Wednesday. Remember? I whined about people not emailing me and asking me questions, and I immediately got email. And it worked. Whining works. You rewarded me. So I'll continue to whine as appropriate. I appreciated the emails that I got. The questions were interesting. A couple of them will become lecture material in the next unit. But I've noticed that on Mondays from 1 to 3, Julie is sitting in the office having office hours, eating her lunch, talking to the work-study folks who work in the office, asking me if I have anything she should do. Today I did, but that was unusual, because usually she's ahead of everything. So those of you who are free might consider coming to see Julie and talking about exams, papers, questions, life, anytime. 1 to 3 in C150 Living Learning. If you want to talk to Julie and aren't available on Mondays from 1 to 3, email her. Her email is on the syllabus and on the website. She also loves email and would be happy to chat with you on email or set up an appointment with you to go over anything that you're concerned about. If you did not do well on the multiple choice part of the exam, and there were 50 items, the average was 37 or 38. If you got less than the average on the multiple choice part, if you got 37 or 38, you're probably in pretty good shape. Below that, I would urge you to go to the Learning Co-op website and find out when they're doing their multiple choice exam taking tips workshops. They do them regularly, and they'll be happy to tell you when they are, particularly if you're not used to taking big multiple choice exams in big courses. Some of you had the privilege of not having to do that as you were growing up, and here they are, boom, you go, and so. Consider those. They are useful. People who have done those workshops in the past have said, ooh, that's really helpful. And I probably should say that if you got less than the average, I would really, 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 really urge you to do the writing analysis, the exam analysis exercise. And it's not required. It is points. If you don't do it, you get zero and other people get 5, 6, 7, or 8, but that's up to you. But if you didn't do well on the multiple choice, I would certainly urge you, A, to do the analysis so that it might help you, and B, so you get the points that you will need. Good enough? All right. I don't have a clue where I ended on Wednesday, so I'm just going to jump into what I want to talk about today. We're still on cognitive development, and I'm going to spend most of today talking about the constructivist approach to understanding how intelligence develops. And I really would like to be able to use the chalkboard, but I can't make the lights that illuminate it work. For those of you sitting in the dusk, the gloom in the middle, I do have an announcement, which is that the university has purchased the scissor thing, the telescoping platform that they have to use now to get up there, OSHA rules, to change those bulbs. They used to do it, I don't know how they did it, but anyway, it wasn't safe, so OSHA said, you can't do that, so they bought the equipment. It's due for delivery on Wednesday. It probably won't be here in time for class, but by next week, I'm expecting those lights to be on and these to be functional so that I can use the board. Hope springs eternal. All right, so what I will do instead is draw up here. On that. Okay. And what I want to draw is a timeline. Those of you who know me know that everything goes from left to right, and that's from zero to old age. And it's patently obvious in this unit that babies don't think the same way you do, and I don't think the same way you do, or I don't think about the same things, maybe I think the same way, and old people also see some changes in the way they think, and the challenge in this unit is to understand how those changes take place and what they consist of, what is happening when people develop cognitively. And if we look at the first unit, the biology, we see times, as I've said in the first unit, when the brain changes and we see lateralization. You decide whether you're right or left-handed. We see some shifts during the 5 to 7 period with better integration of the brain. We see puberty. And as we go on through adulthood, we see the beginnings of deterioration. Biologically. Now, what people who watch children and adolescents grow up have known for many years is that the way people think and what they think about changes. And there's pretty good evidence that the changes in what's going on cognitively parallel the changes in the brain. For example, it's pretty clear that as the brain starts to deteriorate, people's cognitive functions deteriorate. And that happens very quickly if the brain is deteriorating quickly. So if you experience a stroke in your 60s, 70s, or 80s, it's quite likely that intellectual functions will be at least temporarily drastically altered as the brain is unable to support them, as the brain is not functioning adequately. They're temporary if the harm to the brain is on the non-dominant side. They're permanent, typically, if the damage is on the dominant side of the brain, or those that are localized in particular areas are likely to be permanent if the function, the cognitive function, is localized on one side or in the area that's been damaged. Okay. One of the things that happens early on as the brain is lateralized is that we see kids beginning to talk. Oh my goodness. And next week I'll spend a lecture talking about language specifically and what it is, but I see a hand. If a function is lateralized, that is, if it's on the dominant side and the damage is on the dominant side, then the loss of function is likely to be permanent. If it's on the non-dominant side for those functions that are lateralized, if it's on the other side, that means, then the damage is likely to be temporary. But it depends on the extent of the damage. Language is probably the easiest to describe that in, because if you have damage, language is clearly lateralized in both sexes. And for most of, for those of us who are right-handed, it's on the left side primarily. But the right side of the brain participates in language processing. So if you have damage on the non-dominant side, as a right-hander, it's my right side is my non-dominant side. If that part of the brain that participates in the processing of language is damaged by a stroke or tumor or injury, then I'm likely to see some change in language, some deterioration, but that's likely to be temporary. It'll recover within a few months, typically. If that same damage occurs on the dominant side, then it's more likely that the damage, or the change in my language functions, will be permanent in adults, after puberty, in adolescents and adults. What I just said applies to the post-pubescent brain. It does not apply to the child's brain, which is still plastic enough, is changeable enough, that damage to the dominant side, even if it means total loss of language, does not mean permanent loss of language, because the non-dominant side still has the ability to take over linguistic functions. So during childhood, damage does not necessarily lead to permanent loss of function, even on the dominant side, because the other side is still there and still can take over the functions. So if you're starting to learn language, for example, and suddenly lose the function on your dominant side, you may lose language totally and start over babbling. And I'll elaborate on that on Monday. But you'll start over with language and most likely fully recover if the damage is localized on the physical damage is on one side. Okay? More than you asked for. Now, what happens when we start to talk is that we are representing our understanding in a different way. One of the frustrating things about working with kids who don't talk yet is that it's clear that they know things and they understand things. They can solve problems. They can create problems. They can ask questions in primitive ways, but they can't represent their understanding to us linguistically. The beginning of the development of speech is a major change in the child's cognitive ability. Language means that it can represent its understanding in a way that communicates directly to other people. And it also means that we can talk to the child and convey information, convey ideas, without having to act them out. Kids understand what we say. We can give directions. So there's a period of time between about 18 months up to 5 to 7 when the major focus is on working on linguistic representation and other forms of representation of what we know. Sometime around 5 or 6, kids begin to change the logic of their thinking. And they begin to accept some of the conventions of our logical thinking. Before 5 or 6, kids say the darndest things. Kids have wonderful imaginations. They say things that don't make any sense, or they make incredibly wonderful, clever mistakes. Those drop out gradually, starting at 5 or 6 or 7, and kids begin to insist that there is a logical world, and they begin to act as if the world is logical. And during the elementary school years, they practice developing their understanding in simple, logical ways. As they enter adolescence, sometime around 11 or 12 or so, puberty takes off, they begin to ask different kinds of questions, and they begin to think in a different way. And we say that they are developing abstract thought. We recognize that they begin to argue differently. They argue more intelligently. They start to win arguments. They start to understand the world in pretty much the same way adults do. And during adolescence, they refine those skills and they become more skilled at them. They manage the subject matters of high school. They go on to college. They think about the future. They do planning. They can think about philosophy and religion and theology and all of those wonderfully abstract subjects that children have a great deal of difficulty with. During adulthood, people refine the skills that they've developed during childhood and adolescence, and they continue to develop information, knowledge, and in the areas in which they use their minds, the tasks that they apply their intellectual processes to, they may become experts. They become really, really good as they acquire experience and learn from their experience across the adult years. That's why your parents think they know better than you, because they've made all the mistakes that they're trying to keep you from making. They understand some of the experience that they have had, and they've developed confidence in their knowledge about it. They think they're experts on life, or school, or driving, or relationships, or work, or whatever it is that they've had experience with that is greater than your experience. And then, as we get older, and the brain begins to suffer the small insults that it suffers, the abuse that we do to it by abusing our cardiovascular system, our intellectual skills begin to slip. And we have what we typically call senior moments, many of which I think are had by seniors in college, but not doesn't necessarily mean senior citizen. Okay. So keep that in mind, that the way we think, what we think about, the way we communicate about our thinking, the way we use our intellectual skills, change in the first part of life as the brain continues to mature, and in the middle and later parts of life, depending on the experience that we have, what it is we're using our intelligence for, and then later, the changes are based on what's happening to the brain as it suffers, if it suffers. I don't want to make deterioration sound inevitable. And we'll talk about that on Wednesday. For the rest of today, I'm going to be drawing primarily on the work of Jean Piaget, who is one of the people who has told us more about the development of intelligence and knowledge than anybody else, and whose work is fundamental to our understanding of intellectual development and of education, fundamental even to the work of people who make their careers based on finding small flaws in his work. One of the things that constantly amuses me is that in the text, they describe Piaget's work, and the descriptions are pretty good. And then the authors feel compelled to describe research that disagrees in some way with some small part of Piaget's research or a prediction that he made. And you'll find that in each of the chapters on intellectual development. There's some question raised. But if you step back from those questions, if you step back and look at Piaget's general description of how and why intellectual development takes place, you see that the people who argue with him or think they have contradicted something that he said, that they have done nothing to undermine his general conception of how intellectual development happens. But it's a very robust description that he has given us, and it has led to thousands of research studies and generally an understanding for most of us about how cognitive development happens. Piaget describes four major... Let me talk about who he was first. This is more fun. Then I'll go to why development happens. Piaget was an interesting character. He was born in August, I think August 9th of 1896. We celebrate his birthday in our household, his and Eric Erickson and Sigmund Freud's. Sigmund was May 6th, 1856, and I don't recall offhand when Eric Erickson's was. But, you know, if you're a developmental psychologist, you celebrate all those birthdays. You probably have your own Dale Earnhardt Jr. or, you know, somebody whose birthday you celebrate. Fish, I don't know. Rod Stewart. I don't know who you celebrate, but I'd be interested to know who you celebrate. Piaget was born in Switzerland, and his father was a philosopher and teacher, and he came from a family that includes some watchmakers. You can't be born in Switzerland without having some connection to watchmakers. And his family is, in fact, part of the family that makes those very expensive Piaget watches from Switzerland, which most of us can't afford. Piaget turned out to be a pretty smart little kid. Switzerland, as you know, is a country that encourages its citizens to be able to speak all of the languages that the people around them speak, and since they're bordered by France and Italy and Germany, most people speak at least those three. Piaget was also fluent in French, in English, which I discovered one day when I was a graduate student. We hosted him at the University of Minnesota, and they had a nice party in his honor. And when he lectured, he always lectured in French and had somebody translate. It turns out that he did that not because he wasn't fluent in English, but because it gave him time to think about what he was going to say next. Just think how much more intelligent I would seem if I spoke in some language and Julie translated, and you know, then I could think about what I was going to say next instead of just going off. So Piaget was at the party, and several of us were engaged in a heated discussion about, I should tell you, this was 1967, 66, and the United States was involved in a war in Vietnam, which many of us did not approve of, and the French thought was suicidal on the part of the United States because they had already been chased out of Vietnam and thought that we weren't any smarter than they were and we should leave the Vietnamese to solve their own problems. So Piaget was in the next circle with his back to the group that was talking about Vietnam, and he suddenly turned around and joined that conversation in fluent English. He'd been following what was going on, and he challenged one of the speakers about some point that he had made about Vietnam and proceeded to have a very lively discussion of why the United States was going to get its butt whipped in Vietnam, which, as you know, we did. Except according to Senator Aiken, who had the right approach to Vietnam. He said, we need to declare victory and get out, which is eventually what we did when the Vietnamese chased us out. But Piaget was fluent and read in and wrote in a number of languages during childhood. It always makes me feel inadequate. When he was about 11, he liked to observe nature, so he was out in a park one time and he saw a partly albino sparrow. The text, I think, says it was a partly albino pigeon, but it was a sparrow. And he sent a note to the local Audubon bird watchers group about it and its markings. And that was his first scientific publication. It was followed by about, 1,000 more, including several dozen books. He got interested in high school in the mollusks in Lake Geneva, and so he started writing articles about them. He was interested in the fact that there were several different kinds of shellfish in the lake, and they inhabited different species, inhabited different parts of the lake. That's a very important beginning to his understanding of intelligence, because he began to ask, how is it that they know which part of the lake they are adapted to? Why do they survive in and thrive in one part of the lake and not in others? And the differences in the environments are connected to the differences in the species which have adapted to those environments. That's an important point. On the basis of that research and the publications, he was invited by the director of a natural history museum to come and work for them to take over the mollusk collection. And he wrote back and said, well, I think I should finish high school first before I take a job, and then actually I want to go to college. So he did college, and then he did graduate school, and here's where I begin to really turn green. He finished his doctorate at 20. The European university system permits you to do that because what you do is sit in on as many courses as you want and then take an exam. There's none of this, you know, you've got to have this course and that course and this course, and you've got to take 4 years to be a nurse and that kind of stuff. You just take the exam and you get the degree if you pass the exam, which he did at 20. And here are a couple of other interesting points. He knew he was too young to get a teaching job at 20. That's what you do as a person with a doctorate in science. So he sat down and said, okay, what would I like to do for the rest of my life? What do I need to study? And he wrote a description of what there is yet to be discovered. And he said, well, I'm pretty good at biology, which is essentially what his degree was in. I know a lot about mollusks and their adaptation to different environments. And it seems to me that human beings, as organisms, need some study. And that particularly human beings are really cool because, he didn't say cool, he didn't use that kind of slang. Human beings are quite fascinating and interesting because we think. And our adaptation is not just the adaptation that we have as a species to the world that we live in. We are born without the knowledge that is necessary for us to adapt to our individual environments. What if I undertook as a biologist to figure out how human beings become intelligent adults? How do babies acquire knowledge? Where does it come from? How do you understand it? What's it based on? And let's just study that for the rest of my life, which is what he did. Now, it was very helpful that he was a biologist. Remember, he's going to study cognitive development, which is usually what psychologists study. But he said, no, I'm going to see if I can understand it as an adaptation of the individual to the environment that it is in. He said, I need to start studying appropriately. So he went to an insane asylum. There's always a good start. You want to study knowledge. He said, I want to go find out how people think who are, in fact, disordered in their thinking. So he went to an insane asylum, and he worked with a psychiatrist there, and he interviewed patients and tried to figure out how they understand the world. One of the neat small world experiences is that it was the same psychiatric clinic that Sigmund Freud had worked in when he was becoming a psychiatrist way back. Freud had gotten his doctorate in biology too, physiology in fact, by studying the developing testes of eels. Guy had sex on his brain very early on. Then Piaget went to Paris and got a job in the lab of Alfred Binet. And Binet was studying children, and Piaget thought that would be interesting to do. If you're going to understand how knowledge develops, then let's go look at children as they develop. And Binet had the responsibility to create a test to identify children who were not going to do well in school. The Paris school system thought, and the French school system thought, that they could do that. And he was developing tests to give to children who were going into school to see which ones were not likely to succeed. And that's what an IQ test does, and it does it quite well. Binet, by the way, was not interested in seeing who should be excluded from school. He was interested in the kids who were likely to fail so that he could put them in a remedial program and bring them up to speed so that they could succeed in school. So he was, in fact, an enrichment-oriented special educator. Piaget was a very bad test giver. He was assigned to translate an English intelligence test and standardize it on French children. When you standardize a test, you have to learn to give it in a standard way so that you give it exactly the same way to several dozen or hundreds of children, and you record their responses, and when they tell you something that's wrong, you say, mm-hmm, and then you go on to the next question. You don't say, you idiot, how can you think that? You say, mm-hmm, and you go on to the next question. You don't give them any feedback about how they're doing because that shapes the way they respond to you. Piaget was a very poor psychologist. He couldn't stop asking the kids, well, tell me more about that. Why would that be? Explain that to me. Nobody does that on an intelligence test. You're ruining the test if you do that. But he got interested in how kids understand the world that makes them say dumb things, wrong things, things that adults don't think are right. But his interest was in how kids do develop the knowledge that they have, and therefore you have to think about what is it that they don't understand. So while he was a lousy test giver, he was collecting kids' mistakes. What is it that they understand well, and what is it that at particular ages they don't understand? And then let's see if we can figure out why they say the dumb things they do. For example, why would a child say something at four like, it's raining because I brought my umbrella? Kids say that. It's raining because I brought my umbrella. Is that why it rains? No. Many of us bring our umbrellas places. In fact, my wife did it on Saturday. We were going out and I said, should I bring the umbrella? And she said, yes, that'll make sure it doesn't rain. So we do think in some way that there's a connection between the rain and the umbrella. But why does a four-year-old say, it's raining because I brought my umbrella? Does she really believe that the umbrella causes the rain? Probably not. Although Piaget used that example to support his assertion that children are pretty egocentric. They really do think of themselves as the center of the universe. And they do. That particular mistake is because there's a differentiation in language that children haven't made yet when they make that mistake. And that differentiation is this one. It's a problem in understanding causality and cause and effect relationships. If something happens, kids know there's a cause. They figured that out pretty early. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that if a child sees a ball rolling past, early on the child will follow the ball, but eventually the child will figure out that the ball came from somewhere. Something probably caused it to roll. That something might be a person. So instead of chasing the ball, the kid turns around and looks at where the ball came from, looking for the cause of the ball rolling, which is the effect. Okay? So kids have figured out fairly early that for every effect there is a cause. Rain and umbrellas have a cause and effect relationship. Right? My wife believes that if I bring the umbrella, it won't rain. So it's a preventative. That's a grown-up joke. What really happens is that when we think it's going to rain, we use the umbrella. We carry it. Umbrellas are neat because they fold up, so you can just carry it. But if you're seeing a whole bunch of umbrellas raised over people's heads, it's likely that it's raining. People tend, right, to put them up when it rains. So rain causes umbrellas, often. And what the child is doing is saying there's a causal connection between the rain and my umbrella. So the kid says, it's raining, I brought my umbrella. Now, in the middle of that sentence, we need a word that says there's a causal connection. It's raining, I brought my umbrella, what's the causal connection? The kid says, because. It's raining because I brought my umbrella. And everybody laughs and says, isn't that cute? She's so egocentric. What the kid could have said is, that's why I brought my umbrella. Or, so. Or, if it's an old English child, you could say, hence, thus. All of those causal words. So, that's why, and because. What the child has done, and typically, four-year-olds know all of those, not the hence. They know the because, that's why, and the so. They know them. And they know that they refer to cause and effect. It's raining, that's why I brought my umbrella. It's raining, so I brought my umbrella. It's raining because, whoops, there's a problem. And the problem is that because reverses the direction of the causality. What the child really, I think, understands is that I brought my umbrella because it's raining. The relationship between cause and effect is different in the case of that's why and so and because. They're opposites. But the child hasn't figured that out yet. The child hasn't differentiated them so that she can connect the two events, the rain and the umbrella, in the appropriate cause and effect way. The child has an undifferentiated category of causality words that she's learned from her parents. And she can use them and does use them interchangeably, which isn't quite appropriate. She has to eventually figure out that cause and effect go in one direction. And that's why and so refer to left to right in this case, and because refers to right to left causal relationships. Now what Piaget did was to collect a zillion examples of kids' mistakes and a zillion and a half tasks that somehow people think might be interesting to look at. And he studied how children over time deal with those tasks. And he came to his general conclusion, which is that children develop their knowledge from acting in the world. They do things, and from their actions, they develop schemas of understanding, and they gradually elaborate those and integrate them so that their understanding becomes larger and larger. A simple enough notion. He published a book a year during his 30s, became the director of the Jean-Jacques Rousseau Institute for the Study of Education at the University of Geneva. Harvard gave him a doctorate when he was 40, in 1936, and he continued to, an honorary doctorate, you know, one of those things, when he was 40. That really makes me green with envy. And then he continued to work until he died in his late 80s. Okay. Now, back to, why does development happen in the first place? There are four reasons. And all of these are operating all of the time. One of them is maturation. He was a biologist. He saw that the body was changing. I've referred to the brain changes. And the sensory systems, the brain and the motor systems, become more complex and interconnected. And it was evident on his part, he didn't even have to say it, that the mind, which is developing knowledge, is based in a brain which is maturing. And as it matures, the way we think changes. Experience causes development. Experience consists of activity in the world, doing things. And he was interested in the familiar activities that we do, observations that we make of our own actions and their consequences. When you act, and there's a consequence, that's a cause and an effect. There are things to be explained in the world, so kids go out and try to figure out how to explain them. They make up explanations as they get able to talk. They attempt to use and explain their actions. And they have experiences of failure to make things happen. All kinds of activities and the consequences of those activities feed the development of knowledge. It is the experience that we're trying to understand. And activity is key to that. Social transmission. A lot of the things that we know, we heard from other people. All of your vocabulary, except for the words you make up, come from other people. So it's important that we have social experiences. It's important that we spend time studying things and talking about them with other people. We go to HDFS 5 twice a week, and I try to transmit things to you socially. Teaching and reading are part of social transmission. But having something transmitted to you by somebody else, not telepathically, but linguistically usually, requires that you have knowledge that can make sense out of whatever it is you're hearing. You have to be ready for it. So for me to lecture on cognitive development to a 3-year-old was kind of fun. Actually, my own kids have suggested that part of their childhood involved having me prehearse all of my lectures with them. And they learned to tune me out pretty quickly because what I was saying made no sense to them. My son later referred to it as psychobabble. I preferred developabble. They weren't ready to understand things that I might have been lecturing about. So you have to have some knowledge to let you interpret or assimilate what the person is trying to say. Shared experience helps in that process. If you have an experience together and then talk about it, one person may be able to transmit vocabulary and understanding to the other who has had the experience and therefore can understand a little better what you're talking about. And finally, the fourth is the process that he called equilibration. That happens internally. Okay. Maturation is biological. Experience is the transactions that you have in the world. Social transmission is the transactions that you have, includes the transactions that you have with other people, especially those who are trying to impart information and knowledge to you, understanding. Equilibration is what you do inside. That is your mental process. That is part of development. What is equilibration? Sorry. Hope I wasn't standing in your way. What is equilibration? Equilibration is the process of trying to make your understanding of the world and your experience make sense. Piaget suggested that there were three essential principles. These are described in the text pretty adequately. And these three principles all come from biology. The same principles. They're simply applied to knowledge as they're applied to biological development. Organization is the tendency to order and to relate information to other information. The body is organized biologically. You know, our gastrointestinal system differentiates and then is integrated into a single system. The heart is organized into four chambers. The connections to the heart are organized to make circulation happen. Okay, so organization is the opposite of randomness. There is a natural, he said, biological and intellectual tendency to make things orderly and to make them fit together. The human mind, he suggests, is designed to organize the experience that we have and the knowledge that we acquire or construct from that experience. We want things to hang together. And hanging together in consistent ways is the basis for logic. Things hang together or are organized in specific and consistent ways. That's organization. The second major principle is adaptation. The mollusks in the lake adapted to changes in the lake and to particular niches within the lake. People adapt to the experience they have, the environments we're in, and the challenges that we face. So adaptation is what we are doing intellectually. We are adapting to the world by learning to understand it, by constructing an understanding of that world. The development of knowledge is fundamentally our way of adapting to make sense of our experience. Adaptation I'm going to come back to equilibration. Adaptation involves two sides of a coin. Assimilation and accommodation. Assimilation means that I understand the world in a particular way. And as I encounter anything new, I interpret that new experience according to the understanding that I have. So that's the way we go about facing new experiences. We interpret them using the experience, the knowledge that we've constructed from previous experiences. So if something looks like a bicycle, I assume it's a bicycle and operates like a bicycle. And that works well most of the time. If I have taught HDFS 5 20 times, probably close to that, and students misunderstand a particular thing over and over again, year after year, then I'll probably try it the same way again. Yeah. Over and over again. And students will misunderstand it in the same way. And that leads us to the other side of the coin. Accommodation is what I do when something doesn't fit my interpretation. When I encounter an experience and I interpret it using my old understanding and it doesn't work, I go, oops, what happened? That looked like a bicycle. I tried to ride it like a bicycle. It fell apart. I guess it wasn't a bicycle. Oh, it was a wire sculpture that an artist had spent hours and hours, and I now owe $5,000 to the artist who built that bicycle that was not a bicycle. It was a sculpture, a representation of a bicycle. I've just had a painful experience with the bicycle. I could not assimilate it, or I did not successfully assimilate it. I did not interpret it correctly. My interpretation was wrong. Okay. And it collapsed. Whoops. I am now in a state of disequilibrium. My knowledge of the world didn't work. The way I understood my previous experience did not apply successfully to my new experience. I am now in a state of disequilibrium. I don't understand what happened. That experience, the disequilibrium that I feel, the failure to understand, is what motivates human beings to explore, to solve problems, to try again, to get a bigger hammer, to frame the lecture material in a different way so maybe they'll understand this time, to change our behavior in some way so we can figure out how the world really works, since we fail to understand it when we tried to assimilate it into our current experience. So what I am doing in the face of disequilibrium is adapting. I'm changing my behavior. I'm experimenting. I'm exploring. I'm trying to reduce the disequilibrium that I feel. And that requires that I gain something new and change my understanding. So the basic, the fundamental process that Piaget is describing is that on the basis of my experience, I have a particular understanding, a set of expectations, a way of thinking about the world. And when I enter a new experience, I apply the way I currently think to that new situation. And I expect to be able to understand it and to operate effectively in that new situation. We all do that. And sometimes it doesn't work. And when it doesn't work, I am confronted with my lack of understanding. That leads to an emotional state called disequilibrium. And that motivates me to try to figure out what went wrong, to explore, to experiment. And As I do that, I am engaging in the other side of the coin. I'm accommodating. I'm changing the way I think so that I can make the new experience consistent with the old by changing the way I understand. So I have to bigger up my thinking to incorporate that more diverse experience. That process is what drives cognitive development. To understand the things we don't understand. To get rid of the feeling of disequilibrium that I don't understand, I'm a failure, it didn't work, I've destroyed the sculpture, whatever it was. And that process is equilibration. What Piaget is describing as the third essential principle is a process of constantly monitoring the way I understand the world, my experience, and making it fit the experiences that I am having. That's an internal process that only the individual can engage in. It is fundamental to the notion of a constructivist view, because I, the person having the experience, am the person trying to make sense of the experience. Only I can do that, and I construct understanding from my experiences. And it's when I don't understand something that I'm motivated to learn. When I need to understand it. When I have failed at something. When I've made a mess. Then I'm motivated to learn something. To make sense out of it. And that process is equilibration. And when I figure it out, when I've changed my understanding, so that it's consistent with my old experience but incorporates now the new experience and my understanding has grown, then I'm relieved. I'm no longer in a state of disequilibrium. Ah! I understand. My mind relaxes and I carry that new understanding into the next experience. That's the process, Piaget says, that makes it possible for us to make sense out of the vast array of experiences that we have, to continually adapt and construct understanding that fits the experiences and adapts us to the world that we live in. Question? I'm sorry, I missed the first two words. Grow out? Can we... What do we want to grow out of? Do we grow out of learning based on disequilibrium? No. That's a lifelong process. If you stop experiencing disequilibrium, your understanding would be stuck. You wouldn't be having any new experiences. Maybe we can arrange it that way if we turn the television off and don't engage in activities. But let me add, this is a very, very important point. It's a very important question. Is disequilibrium always uncomfortable and negative? No. You can choose to create disequilibrium for yourself. You can choose to love to create new experiences to try to understand. You can ask questions that aren't upsetting. You just don't know the answer. So you can say, what would happen if I started to treat my partner as if she were an equal? Huh. You have defined a disequilibrium. You don't know the answer to that question. So disequilibrium is not necessarily harmful, and you can, in fact, become curious enough about any particular subject to raise questions, and a question by its nature is a disequilibrium. And then you go after the answer. What you can learn to do is create disequilibrium that will be useful for you. You choose your experiments. So life doesn't have to be based on making mistakes. It can become based on answering questions. Thank you for that question. I'll see you on Wednesday.